Welcome to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements of Drab to Fab Landscaping. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas to help solve problems and keep you up to date on the latest development in the nursery and landscape industry. For a podcast of today's program and others, visit walteranderson.com and click on the podcast tab. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman. John Clements has the day off today, but we're going to be here talking with you for the next hour about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden. If you have a question for us, would like to comment on the show, or have a suggestion for a topic or guest you would like to hear about, you can email us at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com or follow us on the Walter Anderson Nursery Facebook main Facebook page. Morning, George.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Today's the summer solstice.
I guess it
is. It's the longest day of the year.
I guess it is.
Yeah. And then I start getting depressed because the days start getting shorter.
Do we have classes today?
We do have classes today. Actually, I only know of one class. I know what we're doing in Poway. So Poway today is the 21st. It's water plants with John Clements. So John's going to do aquatic plants for us.
And that's going to be 9:30?
9:30 in Poway.
Okay.
Yes.
If you want to find out what the class is at the San Diego store, if you give them a call, they would be happy to tell you. Classes in San Diego start at 9 o'clock, not 9:30 like they do in Poway. But they'd be happy to tell you what class they might have scheduled for today.
And today's my oldest son's birthday, so happy birthday, Rich.
Oh, very happy birthday, Rich.
Yeah, I know Rich. With him, yes.
Yes, I do. And Rich, thank you very much for your service. It is much appreciated, as is yours, George, and Casey's.
Yes. So.
Multiple people in your family.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. We have a special guest today. We have Greg Rubin from California's own Native Landscape. Did I get that correct, Greg?
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Okay, excellent. So welcome to the show. Thank you for coming. We appreciate it.
I'm honored to be here, guys. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. And not only do you do Native Landscapes, you've also authored a couple of books.
That's right. The first book was The California Native Landscape. It's just went out of print about 12 months ago, but it's still available used, and it was written as a textbook on natives. And the current book is called The Drought-Defying California Garden. It's a paperback, and really gets into, plant selection, and it's still out there doing gangbusters.
Excellent. And you and I were talking just briefly before we came on the air. How long have you been doing this?
Well, I started as a hobby back in the mid-80s. And I started, I was actually an aerospace engineer at that time, but on the side, I was doing, native landscapes for friends and family. And, about 9 years later, I went and got my contractor's license, turned my avocation into my vocation, and never looked back.
You know, it's only been within the past, I'm going to say 10 years or so, that I've gotten a better appreciation for natives myself. I was really always more of a tropical and exotic guy. But I think part of the problem with that was 20 years ago, there weren't a lot of really good native nurseries around. They're just, other than ceanothus and a few salvias and some manzanitas, there just wasn't much out there in natives. But now, with Moosa Creek coming online, Native Sons and some of the other growers, there's a tremendous variety of plant material that's available. And it's beautiful. There are some absolutely stunning native plants available that I just never would have thought of back in the day.
Well, the misconception about natives is that they're going to look dead, dry, brown for half the year, right? And mm-hmm. I'm telling you, I wouldn't be sitting in the studio right now. That's how my customers' landscapes looked. And it was a lack of ability, but it's also a lack of plant knowledge, which is something, the reason I do a lot of talks and seminars is because and write books is to teach people about what's available out there. And one of the great mistakes that's made in native landscape design, which is kind of garden 101, is they don't use enough foundational evergreen plants mm-hmm. to create the backbone. They're so bowled over by all that spring color that they end up with a bunch of herbaceous plants that look like a riot of color in spring and absolute tumbleweeds in fall, right?
Right, right, yeah. Right.
So it's about 75% evergreens like ceanothus, like mm-hmm. manzanita. And you find that these also have a multitude of colors and textures and habits and sizes and you can create color all year long just with the foliar color. And then you sprinkle in your perennials, the color spots right along the pathways, mm-hmm. where you see all that color up front. You can get at it and deadhead it real easy. That's lower maintenance. Mm-hmm. And then you mix up perennials that bloom at different times of the year. So something's always coming into bloom and something else is going out.
You know, and it's funny that you mentioned the variation in all of it. Ceanothus is an excellent example where you'll have some varieties that grow completely flat on the ground and then other species that'll grow into an actual tree if you let it go. So there's a tremendous amount of variation just within Ceanothus.
Ceanothus and also Manzanita.
Manzanita is another one.
And what with Ceanothus is leaf texture and color as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. They've even got variegated. Right. Ceanothus, like yes. Diamond Heights, right?
Yeah, that's one that's relatively new. Hasn't been out, at least not one that we've had for a long time
here. Right.
I was going to say, before we get into plants, individual mm-hmm. plants, you do speaking everywhere. I mean, that's, you've taught for us a couple times here in Poway, and you have a great speaking circuit. And you talk a lot about native plants, but you also do a lot about firewise planting, right?
Yeah.
And that's certainly a topic in the news right now.
Yeah, the hot topic.
I see what you did right there.
Uh-huh, brilliant. Anyway, yeah, the pretty much everything that you thought you knew about fire behavior and native plants and vulnerability is wrong. It's a bold statement, but I've been at this 30 years and we've had our native landscapes have been through now 25 fire events. And
for clarity, I'm sorry, when you say our native landscapes, San Diego proper or?
So this is generally in San Diego, okay. Although I just did a talk and talked to some other designers that use our methodology and they're experiencing the exact same thing. Somebody had three go through the Altadena fires. They all survive.
Okay.
And so the problem is that they've turned plants into the boogeyman. They're blaming the vegetation, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at a picture of Altadena after the fire, the thing that absolutely screams at you is the green. The green, the trees, the shrubs, the lawns surrounding rubble. Mm-hmm. Those plants did not burn down those houses. It's all about home hardening. And unfortunately, those were a lot of older homes that hadn't been built to modern standards, right? Because the new homes generally do really well in fires. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, it just went house to house to house. And what's becoming evident, not just from my end, but from other researchers in the field, is that having hydrated green vegetation around a home rather than burning it down may actually save it.
It's funny that you mentioned that. I was just reading an article within the past couple of weeks, and one of the photographs that they used was from the Palisades fire, and there was a house that was completely burned down. Then there was a setback from the property line. On the property line, I believe it was a row of Italian cypress,
and
it was a tall head. It was a tall green hedge, and then the house on the next side of the property line with the setback was completely untouched, and the hedge, and then they showed the direction of the wind and the direction of the fire. The hedge actually stopped it. It kept it from moving through, and I've seen photographs. Yeah, there it is right there.
That's the article I shared with you and John.
Yeah. And I've seen photographs of, I know there are people that have had, where Italian cypress has gotten a bad rap, but from what I've seen in the pictures of Italian cypress in the fire zone, it's the brown interior dry parts of the plant that burn, but the green parts typically don't. So from what I have seen.
Well, and you touched on a really good, I'm familiar with that article. Mm-hmm. And actually, one of the authors is here at San Diego State, Luca Carmagiani, and then Max, I forget his last name. They're both PhDs. They're both fire scientists. Max mm-hmm. is up in Santa Barbara. It was a wonderful article. We've been saying this for 28 years. And it is so gratifying to finally see verification from other sources that had nothing to do with us directly. I know Luca, but it didn't, I didn't even know he was writing this article, had done this research. And the bottom line is, you know, sometimes you feel like a lone wingnut in the wilderness, you know, and now there's starting to become something of a consensus that's sort of circling around the positions. And it's all about hydration. It's absolutely about hydration. It's typically not about plant selection. That's what people really need to understand. And the corollary that it takes so little supplemental irrigation to actually hydrate a native plant. That's why they've done so well in our landscapes. And yeah, you know, they want to clear everything. Well, those, that vegetation, those trees and shrubs outside of the home can actually save it because they catch embers, they cool embers, and they create deflection, right? You take out all the vegetation, what's left? Your house.
A barren landscape.
A barren landscape, probably full of weeds that are flashy and burn like crazy, and your bare naked house.
Yeah.
There's nothing to protect it at that point. And houses make great ember catchers.
Yes, they do.
They do.
Yeah, especially the open wooden eaves with vents into
we need more soffits to protect the attic. That's another story, yeah.
Home hardening.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting. After the, I'm trying to remember, Cedar Fire was the first big fire. Then there was the Witch Creek Fire. And I went out, we did landscape consultations for people that whose landscapes had been damaged. We went out and it provided them with estimates for replacement costs of plants. And we did, between the two fires, we probably did around 600 or 700 of those. So I've seen everything from stuff that was well protected to stuff that didn't work at all. And I went to a guy's house, not too far from you.
Well, it's my neighbor's house now, because that house burned down.
Yeah. But he had hardened his house and did everything possible to prevent his house, to make his house fire resistant. Even had newspaper articles published about it. And I went out to his house and the only thing that was left was a slab. And his house was completely surrounded by, avocado groves, which did not survive very well, but it was also right on the edge of the canyon. And it was all just native scrub brush coming up the canyon, which was only getting the water that rains. So talking about the moisture content and the fuel content and things like that, he kind of was in the wrong place at the wrong time, I think. But there's.
Yeah, I can speak to that. So I will tell you, number one, that generally, and there's always exceptions to all these rules, right? And I can't guarantee a home won't burn.
You know what, Greg, we're going to continue with that, but we need to take a quick break. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ, and our special guest, Greg Rubin, from California's Native Owned. We're going to be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we are back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman. John's got the day off, and our special guest, Greg Rubin from California's Own Landscape. We've been talking about California natives and I won't say fire prevention, but hardening your landscape and making it less susceptible to fire damage in this area.
Yeah, and there's, you know, a lot of controversy right now because they're really pushing this concept of zone zero, which is the first 5 feet.
The 5 feet, yeah.
And most of our new construction incorporates that. But, you know, if you've got a senior with a 50-year-old azalea growing near the house there, can we expect them, or even that hedge, right? Can we expect them to come along and just rip this thing out? When in fact, you know, if you just clean it up and it's hydrated and you cut it away a little away from, so it's not contacting the house and the eaves, who knows? It may actually help protect that home and catch some embers and deflect them, right? You had mentioned a friend of your guys that, unfortunately, lost their home was in the Witch Creek fire.
Yeah, it was George's neighbor.
And you mentioned that it was surrounded by avocado groves, and then below that you had wildland.
Chaparral, going all the way down to the lake. Yeah.
So, and of course, you know, as we know from orographic lift and that slopes really can play a big part in how, you know, the aerodynamics of all this works. Because these are wind-driven fires. These aren't really fuel-driven. They are actually wind-driven. That's what we need to be concentrating on.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that. During the Cedar Fire, a friend of mine owned a nursery in Santa Elena up in Napa Valley. He was also the chief of the Santa Elena Fire Department. He came down and I called him after everything was said and done and said, you know, what can you do? And, you know, we have customers asking about this for their landscaping. And he said, my advice is that if there's a fire like that coming, he said, just get out of the way. And he said, a fire that's going to jump a 10 lane freeway, he said, there's really not much you can do at that point. But my point to that is it was wind driven because there's no fuel between the east side and the west side of Interstate 15, but it jumped Interstate 15. Absolutely. And burned across Miramar. So,
well, yeah. And that's kind of the fallacy of blaming the vegetation, honestly, instead of using the vegetation to help protect us, right? Mm-hmm. We got to change our paradigms, and it's the most basic level. And, you know, I will tell you that my main mentor when I started in this business was a gentleman named Bert Wilson, the late owner of Las Politas Nursery up in San Luis Obispo. And Bert was also a 14-year Cal Fire fireman. So basically, he'd been beating this stuff into my head since day one, right? And amazingly, when we put his protocols in practice, it played out pretty much as predicted. Right? It's worked, right? And it's almost the exact opposite of the conventional wisdom out there. So in your friend's case, you're surrounded by avocados. You think, oh, avocados are hydrated, you know? Avocados are a really bad actor in most firestorms.
Saw a lot of them burn.
Yeah, they're not like natives. They're not designed to hang on to their water, right? Mm-hmm. They're water hogs, and it just boils off, right? And the leaves are terrible, terrible at transporting fire, just like palm fronds. Okay. Mm-hmm. I've seen some of the worst fires actually motivated by dried avocado leaves, right? So that's one thing. They're not a good fire wall.
Yeah. And where you'd have avocados, you usually have a lot of dead avocado leaves too.
Yes.
They leave
the mulch.
They're self-mulching.
They're ectomycorrhizal. They want the mulch, right? Yeah. Or endo. Anyway, as far as the native vegetation below it, that was not hydrated. That was in a natural condition. So without that little bit of supplemental irrigation, we give them maybe 3/4 of an inch of rainfall a month during summer overhead with MP rotators, very important. Without that hydration, then oils start to predominate and preserve the vegetation during the summer months when there's no rainfall per se.
That makes sense.
And when you're giving it this light irrigation well within their ecological tolerance limits, like a summer thunderstorm or bog drip, not only do they look great, but they're hydrated and they're more moisture than oil. And the live fuel moisture content, LFMC, which is the measure, everyone's measure of fire susceptibility and when the fire season starts and ends, the LFMC is much higher in these lightly irrigated native landscapes that require so little actual supplemental irrigation to achieve good levels of live fuel moisture content. And so it's a pretty simple equation. It's not rocket science. I've done rocket science, actually. But it's not. And we just need to shift our paradigm and stop blaming these plants and seeing how we can use them to actually protect, even if they're not native. It's all about hydration. I'm not a big fan of Mexican fan palms, I will tell you that. Because those 4-foot flaming frisbee fronds flying at 40 miles an hour is some alienating alliteration. That is the prime mover in Rancho Bernardo during Witch Creek Fire and such.
Well, one of the problems that you see with, speaking of the fan palms, is even in landscapes, in homeowners and commercial landscapes, a lot of times people don't prune them. And they leave the dead fronds on them. And right. That's just a Roman candle waiting to go off. Yeah. And unfortunately, in open space where they do grow, they're naturally seeded by birds and they pop up everywhere. And if it's an open space, it's definitely not going to get it's definitely not going to get pruned.
Or supplemental water.
the San Diego riverbed, a prime example of that, where you have the fan palms growing all over the place, and they do catch on fire or are lit on fire from however it may be, and they burn like crazy.
Oh, you saw what happened in Talmadge a few months ago.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That I think that canyon was just full of fan palms, Mexican fan palms. And one of the things, you got to skin them at minimum, because mm-hmm. those petioles, those wooden petioles, burn great too.
Yeah.
But then when you get up into the crown and get a crown fire going because of the old inflorescence, the old flower stalks mm-hmm. and stuff like that, and the debris that's collected there, they're just not a great actor at all. And they are a true invasive weed.
It is an invasive species. Yeah. Yeah. They will grow. They'll grow just about everywhere. And one of the most common places where you see them popping up is underneath utility poles, because the birds will sit on top of the utility poles and they drop the seed, and the seed grows very, very easily. So it's, you really need to get them out. My advice would be to take them out before they get too out of hand.
Absolutely.
Because they really can be dangerous. I mean, they will burn ferociously, and it doesn't take much to get them set off.
I know we want to talk about plants, but to the fire part, you know, there is, as you said, the 5-foot defensible, you know, stripping all of the vegetation, which is going to make my house look horrible. I've got a beautiful home, but it's got a lot of nice plants around it. What is there recourse, or is there a move afoot from people like yourself working with the state and agencies to go, hey, this is not the way to go?
There absolutely is a movement. There's a lot of backlash on this whole thing. And what's happened, government officials need to be performative, right?
Oh, it's a knee-jerk reaction. Something happened, I need to do something.
And it's very panicked up in Northern. See, we've been living with Santa Ana's all our lives and fires down here, so we've had a little more practice. Up there, weather patterns have changed to where they're getting offshore flows, and they're even getting offshore flows during thunderstorm activity, which we don't get down here, mm-hmm. right? Because how often do you have a thunderstorm during a Santa Ana?
Oh.
The natural occurrence was very rare, maybe every 100 years, but now it's every 5 to 10. But up there, it's kind of understandable. They've got a real panic, knee-jerk response. But in that panic, most of the things they're recommending are going to exacerbate the problem rather than help it. And so,
which doesn't typically happen with government action. So that's
right.
Well, yeah. And speaking of that too, and I know it's one thing that's come up a number of times, is just at least in Northern California and actually across the country, forest management. They're on NOVA. It's been a number of years ago now, but when they had the huge fire back in Yellowstone, that almost burned the lodge down, they were highlighting the fact that when they started the national park system, as great as the national park system was, the government decided that people want to go to the national parks and they want to see these pristine, beautiful, preserved parks. So they instituted a program where if a fire started, you put it out immediately. You did not, even if it was a naturally set fire, a lightning strike or something like that, the idea was you put it out so that it did damage the park. So that led to other problems down the road with overforestation, more fuel was around, and it was a contributing factor in a number of different fires from what I understand.
Well, if I can kind of address this.
Yes, please.
Yeah. That's why you're here.
Yeah.
Glad to be here. So forest is actually a very different regime.
Yes.
In our coastal Mediterranean.
Absolutely.
Shrublands,
yes.
Right?
I will give you that.
Well, it's very important actually, because the forest ecology, and there is a case to be made that maybe fire suppression has led to overgrowth saplings, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the intensity of fire has gone up. In general, though, when they have a lightning strike in the forest during the summer months, monsoon season,
mm-hmm.
and those fires typically almost go out immediately. And there's often rain on it, and those are true fuel-driven as opposed to wind-driven. When you get into the chaparral, everything changes. All the fires, 97 to 100% in all California counties since 1916, have been human-caused. The historic Yeah, isn't that amazing?
That is.
The historic fire cycle prior to human habitation, because remember, this stuff was developing, the ecology was developing millions of years ago. Mm-hmm. Humans have been here 25,000, right? Before human habitation, the fire cycle was only about every, I don't know, 70 to 130 years. Because,
really?
Like I say, how often would you have a lightning strike during a Santa Ana wind event?
Yeah, that's true.
Right?
That's true.
And so while you have these sort of localized fires up in the forest, and again, I think there is a case to be made for overcrowding. And mm-hmm. Down here in the Chaparral, unlike what people's perception is, it does not need to burn.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Chaparral needs to burn like your house needs to burn because you have fire insurance. Okay. It is an adaptation to very infrequent but completely catastrophic fire, which then had time to recover completely through, you know, ecological succession. There's a lot of people that advocate for prescribed burns in chaparral. It's absolutely the worst thing you can do. You want to convert chaparral into weedy, grassy cow pasture, just burn it twice in 10 years. Gone. These grass-covered hills here, none of that is native.
We're going to be talking more about that. You're listening to Greg Rubin here on Garden Talk. Forgot the name of the show. Wow. There for a minute. It's been a while. We're going to be back with more Garden Talk right after this, so stay tuned.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman. John Clements has the day off, and we have our special guest, Greg Rubin, from California's own native plants. Yes. And he's a resident expert in native plant landscaping and native plants in general. And Greg, thank you again for coming in and talking with us. We've been talking about, thank you. We've been talking about fire and fire damage, fire prevention, and things like that.
Yeah, so many misconceptions, and the way we're reacting to these fires may actually be making the problem worse. And I think we have a real win-win-win approach here that preserves habitat, preserves beauty, preserves regional identity, mm-hmm. and may save homes. Certainly, we're removing vegetation that's leaving them wide open to ember attack.
That would make, it makes empirical sense to me.
It does. In that article that we shared, we should put that on our website, actually, on our Facebook page. I'll do that. But, you know, I had asked earlier, but sidebarred a little bit, what is being done with Sacramento, to your knowledge, from, you know, experts? You mentioned the two gentlemen that you, professors in your world. Or anything being done to kind of sway their decision?
That's a good question, because, you know, this legislation has been passed and now it's been left up to the local fire departments to implement. And they need more guidance. They're doing their best. But as long as they model these things as fuel-driven, these catastrophic fires as fuel-driven rather than wind-driven, then that basic underlying assumption is going to be fraught with trouble. And so they're telling people to clear everything around the house and, you know, the things we talked about earlier, and just leaving them wide open to attack. And there's a way that's been, there's actually science. There's so much science out there, actually, but they're in this reaction, this almost panicked response, they're not looking at the actual science. And the decisions might seem logical short term, but they're really not looking at what the actual fire behavior, fire ecology is.
Well, one thing that I find kind of interesting now that, you know, with this big push for the zone zero, the five foot space around the house, the first bad urban fire that I remember in my lifetime, and I was born and raised here in San Diego, so the first really bad fire I remember was the Cuyamaca fire back in the early 70s, right? My neighbor thought it was the end of the world, and she was certain that it was going to burn through our neighborhood in Bay Park. But the next worst fire that I remember was the Cedar fire. But that was 23 years ago, I think it was 2000. It was 2001 or 2002, I think, wasn't it? It was over
2003.
2000, October 2003.
Okay. Yeah, I was so, in Hawaii, so I remember
it. So it was over 20 years ago, and it's taken them 20 years to get to this point to even come up with this questionable plan of action. I find that really surprising.
Well, you know, again, everybody's trying to do their best here.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has the right goal in mind, but a lot of what might seem logical in the final analysis may not be. And the zone zero concept, what's really affecting people are existing landscapes and the challenge of having to remove beloved trees and shrubs that are close to the house, rather than maybe just prune them away from the eaves in the house and clean them up, make sure there's no dead vegetation and keep them hydrated, and they might actually catch embers, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's where a lot of the real heartburn's coming from and the expense. And when I do new installations, I automatically don't plant under the eaves, and we'll often put an apron there, decomposed granite or gravel or whatever. You know, I usually don't put the mulch under there.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And so there is a real public response to this. And I feel sorry for the local fire departments because they're just trying to implement legislation. But there is a consensus that's starting to form here from professionals, from botanists, from biologists, from fire ecologists and fire scientists. And, so, you know, I appreciate you guys having me here because it's a chance to get the word out and maybe come up with a really good win-win solution here.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's where it's at right now. There's a lot of pushback on the legislation, on the fire departments. And I'm out, you know, doing a lot of public speaking, trying to get the word out. And a lot of times you try to work with bureaucrats and it doesn't really get through because they're already invested in these positions and the legislation. A lot of times I go straight to the end user. I go to the public, I go to professionals, and hopefully that puts the upward pressure
right
for legislators.
Well, you know, it's interesting when thinking about the 5-foot space. I know in my front yard, I have ground cover that we have it's frame stucco house. Stucco goes all the way down to the ground level. I have ground cover that goes up to the house that's about maybe a foot deep. But from what I've heard, as far as fire damage on houses is concerned, it's when you get heat next to the stucco is not going to burn, but if you have a fuel source or a heat source next to glass, the glass will break, and then it's a secondary fire that lights inside the house, and the house burns from the inside out. I don't see any way how this fleshy ground cover it's Weidelia, which is a fairly common ground cover, but it's very hydrated, it's very wet, and it's probably a good 3 feet below the window. I don't see how that's going to catch on fire and break the glass on the front of my stucco house. What? So it's like you said, it's very interesting where they come up with some of these concepts.
Well, and again, it's, they got to stop modeling them as field driven and look at the wind,
mm-hmm.
and look at the behavior of the wind and how it moves these embers as thick as the fire falls of Yosemite going sideways,
mm-hmm.
right? 80 mile an hour bone dry winds, right? That's what they need to be looking at, how to perturb and slow down. And, you know, let's do green belts around communities instead of planting ice plant.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do oaks and sycamores and native trees and shrubs and ground covers that require a lot less water and maintenance, provide habitat, look beautiful, regional identity, and slow the fire so that the fire department get in there and set up a true defensible perimeter, mm-hmm. right? And it looks amazing, like you're surrounded by nature, right? But it looks lovely. And that's what needs to happen right now. Once the fire gets in the community, you're off to the races, and it goes house to house to house. And that's where some of these hedges played a part in blocking flames from going from one house, or embers from one house to the next. The scorch marks will be on the either the house that burned down, but a lot of times you saw that the scorching was on the inside. In other words, the side contact near against the house, that was scorched, which means that the house burned first and then scorched the vegetation, right, right. Not the other way around. So,
yeah, you know, it's, you know, now after having this discussion with you, as much time as I spent in the field after the Cedar Fire and the Witch Creek Fire, I wish I'd paid closer attention to what I was seeing. But I, you know, some of the things that stick in my mind, it was, I did a estimate for a house on the very south side of Scripps Ranch, where their back fence bordered up to air station property. And the house was fine. The house did not burn. And they had a cedar, about a 10 foot diameter cedar gazebo in the corner of their yard that was right up against the fence. That didn't burn, but you could stand at the fence line and look south, and there was nothing but ash where the chaparral had been. That was all gone. But their yard, for the most part, was pretty much unscathed. I think the thing that they were most concerned about was along the fence line, they had some pygmy date palms that had gotten singed fairly heavily, but they didn't catch on fire. They didn't burn. And their house was fine. And like I said, even something that you would have thought would have burned, especially being right up against an area that burnt ferociously, their gazebo was unscathed.
It's so, because it's cedar, it's timber.
Yeah.
And like I said, the preconceptions need tweaking, and we need to truly understand how fire works in these landscapes and the features. And, you know, they're making cool precast fencing now of concrete. That's it's great. But again, you know, having an oak tree or something, there are insurance adjusters requiring people to rip out their oak trees. And it's like insanity.
Which is why I was curious what was being, you know, said up towards Sacramento with this new zero land, you know, zero zone mentality.
Yeah, I'm trying to work my way up. You know, if any of you listeners have connections in Palisades or Altadena, homeowners groups or fire safe councils, please talk to them. I'd love to go up there.
Now, is this, these regulations that we've been talking about, is this insurance company driven, or is this state driven? Is this regulatory driven?
I think a lot of it started with insurance companies. They're not totally responsible. And again, they're doing what they think is going to be effective. And then that is, you know, people are getting canceled left and right. People that shouldn't be canceled left and right. And that's putting pressure on Sacramento, and Sacramento's responding with legislation that, as we said, might be counterproductive.
Very interesting. You know, speaking of insurance being canceled, a good friend of mine owned an insurance agency here in San Diego. It was State Farm, which they're still writing some insurance in Scripps Ranch, because that's who I have. He said that when the insurance company started pulling out of the area because of the fires, he said that was one of the worst things they could have done, because when you have more companies, you have more competition, but it also spreads the risk out much more. And when you have companies start pulling out, then you have the concentrated risk, and it just makes things worse.
Yeah, this is not a good marketing move. This is not a good sales move.
No.
And, you know, and I'm out there and I'm trying to show, hey, we got a win-win here. Okay. We just need to do it right. And, you know, listen to the science.
You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ, and our special guest, Greg Rubin from California's own Native Landscape Design. We're going to be talking more with Greg when we come back right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back. More Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman. John's got the day off. We have our special guest, Greg Rubin, from California's own Native Landscape Design. Thanks again for coming in, Greg. We really appreciate it. It's been a very interesting talk so far.
Yeah, me too.
And we've talked about we've talked about fire, hardening your house as far as landscape is concerned, and things to watch out for. But let's talk somewhat about plants. And George?
I was going to say you're shifting away from the mic and I'm losing you in my ear.
Okay. Yep. There we go. Yep. So what are some of your favorite natives to use?
Yeah.
And I know there's a wide variety between everything from ground cover to trees, but
yeah, we work with somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 species in my business.
That's actually a pretty good palette.
Pretty wide open. Yeah. Well, there's a native for every situation, right? And one of the things I want to establish right off the bat is that natives or people want to know what's your favorite fire-resistant plant? What's your list? It doesn't work that way. It works about hydration.
Mm-hmm.
And as I stated before, the corollary that it takes so little water to hydrate a drought-tolerant native plant. But having said that, there are just some wonderfully, what I call ornamental natives that have actually been selected or developed specifically for horticulture. And the bottom line is we try to make these landscapes about 75% evergreen with foliar color contrast. And the other 25% are your flowering, often herbaceous perennials that go right along the edges to see the upfront color, easily deadhead them, and you mix up bloom cycles so something's coming into bloom all the time. That's how you do a native landscape. It's going to look great all year long. So if I'm doing a fire-resistant slope, and I've put my MP rotators, my over from Hunter, that overhead
those are fantastic.
That is fantastic
sprinkler heads.
You know, it's not a universal position, I'll just say that, but after 800 landscapes and 30 years, I can pretty safely say that anything we can do to emulate nature, including overhead rainfall type at rainfall level watering, really promotes the ecology and the health of the plants, right? So mm-hmm. MP rotators are like gentle rainfall.
Yeah, I have a number of them in my yard. I've been very, very impressed with them.
Yeah, I tested some of the first prototypes back in the 90s, actually, mm-hmm. and it was like manna from heaven. And we use shredded redwood bark mulch, which they can't ban fast enough up in Northern California, and that's a mistake because it is the best simulant for the natural duff that forms in these shrubland communities that compresses down and is poorly oxygenated. And same with the redwood. After a few months of overhead watering, it's gone from 4 inches thick to an inch thick. And it's knit up like carpeting. It adheres to the soil, poorly oxygenated, and burns with about a 2 inch or less flame height. If you want to call it burning, it's more like smoldering. Mm-hmm. Okay. And yet ensures the hydration health of the native plants, okay, and also prevents weeds, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, having said that, nobody ever called me, okay? I've got so much research and documentation. Some of my favorite plants that are evergreens, and we usually layer it. You know, we start out low, get higher towards the back in a border or in generally even a yard.
Before you name the plant, mm-hmm. are you a purist when you say native plant? Are we talking San Diego County native or Southern California native or the larger Southwest?
That's a good question. That's a good point. Okay, because actually a lot of the natives that we use in horticulture actually come from other parts of the state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody knows Ceanothus Yankee Point. Well, if you look on a map, Yankee Point is on South Monterey Bay. Okay. And which makes them also ideal for some of these fire resistant landscapes in that respect, because they love the supplemental irrigation. It's hard to water Yankee Point enough, to be honest with you. So, and the reason we even are using a lot of these plants is that we in San Diego County are lacking evergreen ground covers. It's because it's so hot and dry that radiant heat just fries them if they try to grow along the ground. Most of your ground covers actually come from the immediate coast. That's the name, like Pigeon Point, Yankee Point, Point Sal, right?
Oh, well, yeah.
Because they've accommodated.
Never thought about that.
Growing low and sea spray, right? So we do have a few down here that grow next to the coast. But evergreen ground covers are very important for pulling a landscape together. They're one of the foundational elements, one of the you know, things that tie the landscape together. So we have tons of ceanotheses. We have tons of manzanitas. We also have stuff like Baccharis. That we love Pigeon Point because it doesn't die out in the middle and looks salty. Mm-hmm. We also use plants like Toyon, the Christmas berry. I also use lemonade berry.
Yeah, Toyon's okay. One of my favorite natives.
Oh, great.
That's same
beautiful actually. Plant.
Yeah, and lemonade berry, I like
them. Yeah.
And so in all the, we have those in ground covers, but we also have small shrubs, tall shrubs, and even tree forms of both manzanita and ceanothus. Mm-hmm. So they often make a good portion of my plant palette in order to create something that looks good all year long and looks designed. These are actually designed mm-hmm. landscapes, right? They look like a landscape. They're beautiful.
As opposed to putting a home in the middle of a chaparral, just dropping it in.
Right? Although I do have that too. Especially Audubonners. They don't care what it looks like. They just want habitat, right?
Got it.
So yeah, from those major groups, those are some of my favorite plants for creating the backbone of the landscape. And then along the edges, we're putting perennials and things like Seaside Daisy.
Okay.
Penstemon, Margarita Bop is a great one.
That's a beautiful plant.
Isn't that great?
It's a really nice plant.
I actually saw Mother Bop before an oak tree fell on it finally.
Oh, really?
Took out Mother Bop and half the house. So. Oh. And then we have Epilobiums, which actually bloom summer, fall, right? So now mm-hmm. we've got a perennial that's giving us color late in the season. Currants. We even have evergreen currant that makes a fantastic mm-hmm. ivy-like ground cover under oak trees.
Mm-hmm.
Honeysuckles. Sages. You need the sages. You need the color. You need the fragrance. And they are party plants. Everything loves sages. I mean, you'll see butterflies fighting off the hummingbirds on sages, okay? Yeah.
Yeah, that's what salvias are, as far as natives are concerned, are really big for me because I remember being up in the mountain, camping up in the mountains, and after it rains, and you can just smell it in the air. It
smells like California, right?
It does. It really does. Like
you took a hike in a canyon somewhere.
Yeah.
And I want to mention real quick that some of the plants that we think are going to be the worst firebombs in a fire situation actually benefit the most from the supplemental irrigation. I'm thinking buckwheat. Buckwheat has done great for us in fires. Covered in green leaves where the ground cover rosemary next to it was a black smudge, you know? So the hydration makes all the difference in the world, and it's not really so much about plant selection.
But there is a concern with some natives with regard to summer water. Would that be a true statement? I mean, not everything can take a bunch of summer water, or?
Well, guys, this is a whole nother show.
We'll have you back.
I'll get
you on the calendar.
Many of you guys that know me know that we've actually discovered the predominant cause of mortality in native landscapes. It's not fertility, typically. It's not soil amendment, although we definitely don't do that. And a lot of times they're very tolerant of water. What it is Argentine ants.
Really?
Yeah.
And I know that you put that in one of your books. There's a little segment.
Yeah, but you know what? Even since those books have been written, we've discovered a lot of things. And
okay, we're having him back, Ken.
Okay.
We just opened up
another.
Would
love to.
Yeah. It's a whole other thing. Yeah. So anyway, that's the biggest problem. Suburban.
So supplemental summer water is not the death that we typically think, that I have heard with regard to native plants.
Think about a lot of these plants, like these coastal ground covers, they come from...
Well, those, yes, you know, but some of the other plants that are more, you know, more chaparral-ish.
The thing is overhead watering.
Got it.
And a good mulch. And what the good mulch does, because people complain, it's not getting wet under the mulch. I said, precisely. I said, that mulch is maintaining a very low level of humidity in the soil, which is what they want. It's absorbing water and acting as a vapor barrier that inhibits evaporation and maintains a beautiful level of humidity. There's all these different kind of approaches that are very different than the conventional wisdom.
Well, I know you're a huge mulch fan, George.
Oh, we have a lot of fruit trees and we have thick layer of mulch on everything in our herb garden, everything. And because of the water, I mean, it cuts down on my, you know, our monthly water bill significantly.
I never really paid that much attention to it till my daughter moved back to North Carolina. And man, do they like to mulch back in North Carolina.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
it is everywhere.
Well, you know, when John's,
a lot of it.
John's a big proponent. I mean, we talk about it all the time. Plus you build soil health and, you know, not necessarily for natives, but all those other plants that like rich organic material.
Absolutely. Yeah. You build soil health for natives too.
Yes.
And it's a different type of soil health. It's not, the redwood breaks down very slowly, right? Which is what we want. But what it promotes is the fungi in the soil.
Yeah.
Mycorrhizal fungi, I'm sure you know what that is. The mulch is actually an integral part of the ecology. It's not just a top dressing.
Fully agree.
I would agree with that as well. Why don't you give our listeners the names, the titles of your books that you have out?
Yeah, so the first book, which is out of print but still available used, is called The California Native Landscape, The Homeowner's Design Guide to Improving
Restoring.
Restoring, thank you. They wrote the byline.
Yeah.
restoring its beauty and
balance.
Yes. Terrible.
Yeah. I ordered the books and I remember having that book for you.
Yeah. If you're looking for it, since it is out of print, I would recommend looking on eBay, alibris.com and Abe's Books. Mm-hmm. Two of my favorites they're like the Warren Brocks of
I love the small companies. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Yeah.
And the other one?
The other one is still doing gangbusters. It's called The Drought Defying California Garden. I won't even do the byline. But second line on that. That's a paperback. It is a lower price point, which I think helped. And it's still out there everywhere.
Wonderful. Greg, thank you very much for coming in. It's been a very informative hour. If you would like to get more information on Greg and what he does, his company is California's Own Native Landscape Design. And you can find him at calown.com. And you can reach out and get more information from him, or if you're interested in using him for your landscape, I'm sure he'd love to talk to you. Greg, thank you very much for coming in. It's been a fantastic hour, and we will definitely have you back to continue this discussion.
It was great.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. We'll be back next week with another hour. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, independent and family-owned since 1928. For more information about plants, products, expert advice, news, classes, podcasts, and more, visit walteranderson.com.